Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. This week, a chef has created a hidden culinary hotspot in Asheville, North Carolina, that's attracting national attention for its eclectic menu and Filipino hospitality.
I'm putting myself out there and my heart. Like, it's really a passion project.
Every through hike of the Appalachian Trail begins with the first step. Famed hiker Jennifer Farr Davis shares hers.
Growing up in the Southern Appalachians, I had always heard of the Appalachian Trail. I had never set foot on it. I'd only spent two nights outdoors before. You know, I was 21, so I thought, well, hiking's technically just walking. How hard could it be?
And the holy month of Ramadan ends with a feast. But war and famine in Gaza muted some of this year's celebrations.
Because I don't think it's right when people are dying from hunger for us to, you know, bring the fancy dinners on.
You'll hear these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. Asheville, North Carolina is known as one of Appalachia's cultural hubs, and that extends to its eclectic dining scene. One of its hidden gems is Ning Jr.'s, which serves up elevated Filipino cuisine. And by hidden, we mean it's a little hard to find. Ning Jr.'s is tucked away in an alley in Asheville's artsy west side. Once inside, though, you feel at home. Folkways reporter Margaret McLeod Leaf recently found her way to the restaurant and brings us this story.
The first thing I notice about Ning Jr.'s is its lively decor. There's a green-tiled open kitchen, fire engine red countertops, and turquoise walls. Adorning the space are items from Chef and Silver Isle Kavazi's personal life, stuffed animals and well-worn books, trinkets from Silver's mom for good luck, a quirky telephone in the shape of a red high heel, and a vibrant painting of Silver's husband, Cherry. But what I'm here for is Chef Silver's popular creation, the adobo.
To me, it is like a quintessential Filipino dish, and it evokes all those flavors. I think a lot of people get their minds blown by it, and I love that.
Inside the kitchen, Silver cooks in a high-powered wok over an open flame.
So I'm just cooking off some onions, and we already have these braised pork cheeks.
The adobo is served with duck on the menu, but today, Silver makes the adobo with pork cheeks that he has on hand. The adobo sauce simmers while he prepares a bitter melon relish to set off the adobo. The dish has a uniquely Filipino flavor profile.
It's really kind of a tangy cuisine. Lots of vinegar and lots of sour, like a very like tart. There's a lot of tart aspects to it.
The bitter melon, a spiky, cucumber-looking gourd, is almost too tangy on its own. But paired with the rich and silky adobo, my mouth waters for more. It's an example of the taste and technical skill Silver is known for. Silver was recently nominated for a James Beard Award and named one of Time Magazine's Next 100 People to Watch. He traces the start of his cooking journey back to his mother. He has fond memories of her cooking.
She would sit down on the ground with this really heavy cutting board and tenderize meat and marinate it. And it was a really simple marinade. It was just soy and oil and garlic and onion and black pepper. But it tasted so good to me.
Silver and his mom loved the soy, garlic, and onion flavors. His mom is Filipino, and his dad is from North Carolina.
They met in Japan. My dad was stationed there. He was a Marine. My mom, a Filipino woman, was working in Japan at a karaoke bar. She was an entertainer.
Silver's parents met and married, and his mom immigrated to the United States. His mom was the only person of color in her new family. Staying connected to her Filipino heritage was difficult.
When I was little, my mom was really seeking some comfort of home and realizing she couldn't find that representation of Filipino food or cooking, or even that warmth of culture that Filipinos bring.
But she found a way to share her culture with Silver.
I would go with her to the Asian market and get all these ingredients that she could tell me about and get excited about, because I think that was like the little amount of representation that she could share with me.
It wasn't until a trip to the Philippines that Silver fully understood his mom's culture and the link between food and celebration.
Manila, I keep coming back to Manila. Simply ain't no place like Manila. Manila, I'm coming home.
I grew up between, you know, Manila and Eastern North Carolina, where my grandparents lived, and really had a lot of experience in Batangas. Batangas is coastal in the Philippines where we would go visit. And because we were in town, they would just bring a reason to have a fiesta and a big celebration around food.
Those fiestas often centered on butchering and cooking a whole hog.
And this was the first time I had seen a pig be sacrificed. And a lot of the cookery in Batangas is no electricity, no gas, just fire. And to see the way these people that are living in these provinces cook with fire and break down pig and really know how to kill a pig with their hands, it's an experience I'll never forget. And also understanding how much I can appreciate food and where it comes from.
Understanding where food comes from and how to prepare it is a quest that's taken Silver from the Philippines to Southern Pork Barbecue to around the world in the restaurant business. He got his start right here in Asheville as a dishwasher in 2011 after a friend had suggested he'd like the city. Soon, he attended culinary school in the area and worked as a chef at Buxton Hall Barbecue, an Asheville institution, before eventually cooking at award-winning restaurants in Tokyo, New York, and Grand Cayman Island. And in 2020, he returned to Asheville to build his own community around food. Within 2 months, he secured a building with a takeout window for what would later become Nang Juniors. When designing Nang Juniors, Silver was as intentional about the space itself as the menu.
I just want to create a space that shows some representation for those that have been seeking it and know that it can exist.
At Nang Juniors, Silver has created a space that welcomes people of all ethnicities, genders, and orientations, just like Silver's mom made room for her culture when she moved to the United States.
I'm putting myself out there and my heart. Like, it's really a passion project.
And a way to honor his mom, whose Filipino nickname is Nanang.
So her nickname is basically, it's an affectionate name for, like, a young girl. And I don't, you know, identify as that, but Nang Juniors is an iteration of that nickname stemming from my mom's nickname because I'm her mini-me.
Silver is sharing his story through Nangs, embodying the flavors, warmth, and joyfulness of home.
I don't think of myself as just, like, a restaurant in Asheville. I think of Nangs as a restaurant in the world. It's so important to be a Filipino restaurant in Asheville because the people need to know what this food tastes like and also understand this, like, level of hospitality that comes from a Filipino.
And the Filipino traditions in Silver's family continue to shape the restaurant. Nang Juniors is in the process of building a stage modeled after the original karaoke bars in Japan, like the one where his mom met his dad.
Simply ain't no place like Manila. Manila, I'm coming home.
For Inside Appalachia, this is Margaret McLeod Leaf in Asheville, North Carolina.
In Appalachia, you don't have to go too far to find folks picking music in the park or sharing tunes on a back porch. And jam circles are loads of fun. Musicians get together, try out new licks, and teach each other songs. But you don't have to play fiddle or guitar to get in on the music. Last fall, Folkways reporter Lauren Griffin brought us this story about the humble spoon.
In a classroom in Fairmont, West Virginia, a diverse group of students has gathered to learn how to play an unlikely instrument, the spoons. Looking relaxed in a Hawaiian shirt, at the center of the circle is their teacher, Jeff Fadan.
So jump in, guys, and do what you can.
The seniors, kids, and young adults who showed up for Fadan's lesson are playing spoons of different shapes and styles. Their practice is accompanied by a dulcimer version of Golden Slippers.
Oh, I'm Jeff Fadan. I have been teaching probably 10 or more years. I find value in it.
Fadan recently retired and now has more time to dedicate to music. He's primarily a drummer, but he also plays the dulcimer. Occasionally, he brings out his spoons.
Using spoons as an instrument, as an alternative for me when I don't know the song. I can contribute to the jam with my spoons. It was just a matter of trying to figure out how to integrate the sound that spoons produce with the rhythm of the song.
Throughout Appalachia, old-time and bluegrass jams are a beloved pastime. For those who want to join, the spoons are an accessible way to dip your toe in. When Fidan moved to West Virginia decades ago, he started attending music festivals. As a percussionist, he was intrigued when he came across the spoons at a festival once.
Not everybody can afford an instrument like a guitar, which is several hundred dollars, and people may not be interested in those instruments or don't have time. But if they are inspired by the sound of spoons, for just a few bucks, you can get something that you can use to participate in a jam session.
Spoons have been played for centuries in Europe, Asia, and the Americas. In ancient history, people used bones to play. You can still find bones players today, but more often people use a wooden set. The spoons became popular in American folk music, particularly in African American jug bands. You might find the spoons accompanied by a washboard or a jug, simple household items that can easily be picked up to carry a tune.
And another general principle is that there's room for only one spoons player in any given band.
Fidan is teaching this free spoons workshop at Paddy Fest. It's a yearly festival held in honor of Paddy Lumen. Lumen was a mountain dulcimer player who taught Fidan, along with many others.
Today there was 9 or 10 people in here. The numbers have been rising the past few years, and people have all of a sudden become interested in spoons. So it just drives me on.
Aspiring spoons players have a couple different options. You could play with metal spoons, or you could opt for a pair of carved wooden ones.
I have in my lap here several spoons of different types. This one was made by Bob Snyder, who's at the festival.
Like their players, each set of spoons has its own personality. Bob Snyder makes his spoons from sassafras, walnut, oak, and other hardwoods.
Even the two of them at the same woods are going to sound different because the grain in them and stuff is fine. I like the ones that look better. I like the walnuts. Everybody's different.
Snyder is an old-time musician from Clarksburg, West Virginia. He's also a woodworker. After seeing spoons around at festivals, he tried making them himself. His design is his own.
Yeah, so I have a block, a square block. After I've cut the outside and done some like rough sanding, then I separate the two halves.
Wooden spoons mimic the shape of kitchen spoons. Cups of different sizes are carved out of the wood. The two halves can then be glued together, creating one singular instrument rather than two metal spoons that have to be held together in a particular way.
But, you know, I mean, I want them to last for people and be comfortable. If it's not comfortable, they're not going to play it.
Wooden spoons might be more comfortable, but some players still prefer metal spoons. Emily Kineski in Wheeling, West Virginia is one.
I've grown up in a bluegrass family or old-time family. Never really picked up on any kind of instrument growing up. So I was thinking to myself, well, wait a minute. You know, I have rhythm. I do have that. I thought it would be interesting to type into the Google window how to play the spoons.
Kineski's twin brother played in an old-time bluegrass group, the Marsh Wheeling String Band. After teaching herself how to play, she joined the band on stage at Ogilvy Fest.
It was always kind of a joke at first, and people just thought it was funny. And I thought that was funny, too, but after a while, I wanted it to be a more of a serious thing.
Playing the spoons involves kind of beating yourself up. Your body is part of the instrument.
I've taken my jeans off, and my whole entire thigh is covered in bruises from just hitting it. And I don't think that's supposed to happen again. I was probably just a little overly excited and hitting my thigh harder than I should have, most likely trying to make it louder.
Kineski has honed her skills and can turn a clamor into a tune. She explains that playing the spoons is not just about the sound you make, but also about the performance. When she gets on stage, she becomes the star of the show.
The drag is usually the big one of the night. It's the big applause getter.
A drag is a technique where you sweep the spoons across your fingers.
Done not just the hand and the knee, but the elbow and the knee. It doesn't sound any different, but it just looks different, and people got really crazy when I did that last time.
Kineski has delighted listeners with her spoons at open mic nights, on stage at festivals, even at her own wedding. These days, her work as a nurse and a mother keep her busy, but she says she'll never retire from the spoons.
I love it. So easy if you can just have rhythm, practice. It'd be a really cool instrument to play that doesn't really require, you know, formal musical training. And also, it's different. It's not something that you see every day.
So next time you're putting away your silverware, give it a try. Play along with the rhythm to a song, find a local bluegrass jam, or take a free workshop next year at Paddy Fest. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Lauren Griffin.
Those first two stories are part of our Folkways reporting project, which covers arts and culture in our region. You can find dozens more folkway stories at our website, wvpublic.org. Communities throughout the region rely on volunteer fire and rescue departments. It's a lot of work training to fight fires and save lives. But volunteers do that on their own time, and often on their own dime. Paying for equipment is another question altogether. Near Virginia's highest mountain, the Mount Rogers Fire and Rescue Department has found creative ways to raise money. Radio IQ's Roxy Todd reports.
It's April, but new fallen snow covers the spruce trees on top of White Top Mountain, where the local fire and rescue department hosts their annual Maple Festival. Inside the fire hall, bands play old-time and bluegrass music. Dancers are flat-footing on the wooden floor. Volunteers have been at work since dawn making pancakes and sausage for thousands of customers. Ralph Norris is the fire chief and rescue captain for this community.
We just financed a brand new tanker at the end of last year. It was $400,000. And so this festival here is going to help us make a lot of our payments on that truck.
Across the country, volunteer fire departments fundraise all kinds of ways. Many try bingo. Here in White Top, not far from where Virginia meets both Tennessee and North Carolina, the fire department is leaning into food and music from their area as a means to raise money. In addition to the Maple Festival, they also host a ramp festival in May. Ramps are wild leeks that grow in the forests of Appalachia. And they have a sorghum festival in October. Sorghum is like molasses and is another specialty food found mostly in central Appalachia.
Yeah, we do three of these festivals.
Randy Lewis has been a volunteer firefighter here for 35 years. He remembers the first fire he helped fight before he joined the department. A house down the road caught fire.
I stopped. It was actually my grandparents. So I was there, and whenever the fire department left, I joined with them. So,
like most volunteer fire departments, finding people to join is a struggle.
It's getting real tough to get volunteers.
This Maple Festival helps with that a bit. Because it's an event that draws just about everyone from the community into one space, it's an opportunity for the fire department to do outreach and recruitment, says Norris.
Trust me, we've talked with everybody we can think of ways to recruit people.
For those who want to help but can't commit to joining the fire department, Norris finds a place for dozens of volunteers at the festival. Tom Revels is one of them.
This is the best community I've ever lived in. And the most community-minded group of people I've ever lived around. This is just a way to contribute and to be a part of what everybody represents here in this community.
Revels is selling maple syrup from sap that was tapped on nearby trees, cooked down for hours. On the table in front of him are golden-colored candies in the shape of maple leaves that were made from that maple syrup. And it's just a way they're adding a little sweetness to fundraising. In Grayson County, I'm Roxy Todd.
Coming up, my conversation with long-distance hiking star Jennifer Farr Davis. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, offering 31 bachelor-level degrees and 6 master-level degrees for students of any age. More information at concord.edu.
Through hiking season is in full swing on the Appalachian Trail. Northbound hikers got started from Springer Mountain in Georgia back in March, while southbound hikers from Mount Katahdin in Maine will be setting out in a few weeks. Few people know the Appalachian Trail better than Jennifer Farr Davis, a North Carolina native who's thru-hiked the AT 3 times. In 2008, on her second thru-hike, She set the record for the fastest Appalachian Trail hike by a woman. 3 years later, she thru-hiked it again, and this time set the record for the fastest known time on the Appalachian Trail by anyone up to that point. Davis has become a celebrity in the world of outdoor recreation. Last year, I invited her on to talk about some of her hikes and how they shaped her identity as an Appalachian. Jennifer Farr Davis, thank you so much for coming on Inside Appalachia and speaking with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So you have thru-hiked everywhere. You've thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail. How did you first get into this, though? How did you first get into hiking and these long-distance hikes?
You know, without realizing it, I think the mountains were just always a part of me. I grew up in Western North Carolina, and looking around, like, I always saw the mountains and always saw the forest, and quite frankly, took it for granted and thought it was normal and thought everywhere must be that beautiful. But then I started traveling. I went to college, and really it was when I graduated college at 21, you know, faced this problem of really not knowing what to do with my life, where I was going to go, what I was going to do for work, who I really was. And I just wanted time and a place to figure things out. So growing up in the Southern Appalachians, I had always heard of the Appalachian Trail. I had never set foot on it. I'd only spent 2 nights outdoors before, but I thought, hey, I know it's a long trail. It usually takes 5 or 6 months to hike. Sounds like an adventure, seems affordable. You know, I was 21, so I thought, well, hiking's technically just walking. How hard could it be? And so I set off on my own from Georgia with the goal of walking all the way to Maine. And after 5 months, I made it there and I was a different person. And, you know, I've never looked back after that. I've very much felt like a part of me belongs outdoors in the forest.
And you've hiked the Appalachian Trail 3 times, I guess. What pulls you back? What's pulled you back to that particular through hike?
I mean, the Appalachians, they have my heart, really does. And there is some sense of roots and connection and in the United States, especially, so many of us are looking for our roots and taking DNA tests and trying to find out, who am I? Where did I come from? What's my heritage? What's my culture? And I think at some point in my life, I just decided I was Appalachian. You know, it's like, well, I'm a mutt, but this is where I'm born. This is where I grew up. This is where I choose to live. And going to the Appalachian Trail, because hiking all over the world, you realize different places, different mountains, they all have different feels, different energies. And the Appalachians to me are always just this wise, maternal, wrinkled old grandmother or great grandmother who is so welcoming and so wise and just wants to, you know, invite you in and share wisdom. And so when I'm on the Appalachian Trail, just the beauties and the details and the biodiversity and the fact that the mountains are some of the oldest in the world, if not the oldest, like that essence and spirit is there. And every time I go out there and hike, whether it's the full Appalachian Trail or just taking my kids out, I think that is, you know, that is what I am taking home with me, the wisdom and the nurturing spirit of Appalachia.
So you mentioned how you took to the Appalachian Trail partly to find yourself. And then you allude to a point in time in which you decided that you were Appalachian. Like that's part of your identity. Do you remember a pivotal moment that helped crystallize that thought for you along the way?
Yes. And it's funny because I think so much of the transformation or growth or lessons or what you have it on long distance trails happens over time. It's not something that occurs in a moment. But I did have an experience when I was hiking over the ridges of Roan Mountain, which is on the border of North Carolina and Tennessee. And it's one of those places where you hike out on this grassy ridge and you get 360-degree views. There I was at sunset and I could see undeveloped mountains all around me. And the sky was changing color and the mountains were, you know, changing colors at the end of the day. And I was the only one up there. And I could hear the birds and the flame azalea had started to bloom. And it's also like a spruce fir mountain, so it smells like Christmas even in the spring. And there I was in that moment looking around, and it just hit me that I was a part of it. Like, I was a part of nature. I was a part of that scene. And at first, that didn't make sense to me because growing up, you know, I thought nature was cool, beautiful, but it was out the window. Like, I saw it as separate. And there, here I was in this moment looking around, and I was like, wait a minute. Like, biologically, I am a part of all this. And then I thought it, you know, I thought about it through kind of like my spiritual lens. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm a part of creation. Like, I'm a part of nature. And when I accepted that truth, I was changed. Like, right away, I remember like feeling filled up. And the first thing I think that changed was I felt beautiful, like beautiful, not in a cultural, societal way, not in a billboard, magazine, social media type of way. Like, I felt beautiful because I felt connected to mountains and forest and wildflowers. And like, it was just such a powerful sense of beauty. And then I felt a little bit wild, and I started to feel responsible for what was around me because, you know, now I see myself as a part of this ecosystem. So that moment looking around and realizing that I was a part of nature and a part of Appalachia, that truly changed my life.
I understand you collaborated on the creation of a book that came out in 2019 titled, I Come From a Place, Appalachian Watercolors of the Serpentine Chain. Do you have an excerpt from that you wouldn't mind reading for us?
These are not mountains that pride themselves on distant views and vast horizons. This is a land of details and knowledge. There are more stories, truths, and mysteries hidden under the thick canopy of the Appalachians than could ever be counted. And the annals are ever increasing. The aura of her calling is symbolized by the conglomeration of minerals known as serpentine that lie beneath her surface. For centuries, the serpentine stone has been revered for its ability to bring out inner strength, create new pathways, and conjure wisdom. This primal rock with its green hues connects the mountain chain with a Celtic spirit that is mostly unseen but always felt, an omnipresent aura that is resilient, resourceful, and sage. This is the Serpentine Chain.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So how did that book come together?
That book is actually, it's an artistic collaboration between myself and Alan Shuptrine, who's a really renowned watercolor artist from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he really, you know, he's the true talent. He did the lion's share of the work for that book. But he also really empowered me, I think, as the artist who's writing the prose and sort of this long essay to go with the paintings. He wanted me to be really creative. It was such a creative project. And it wasn't that hard for me to be creative at that time because I had very young children and I wasn't sleeping very much. And so my life already felt like this haze. And I think I just leaned into the creativity of like bringing life into the world, having young children, being sleep deprived. And part of the story for that book is this allegory. So there's truth and fact and statements about the Appalachian Mountains in that book. And then there's this story that harkens back to my relationship with the Appalachian Mountains and how it's always seemed like this wise old maternal guiding force. And so in the book, there's this story and this presence of this older woman who is showing the secrets of Appalachia to the reader. And it gets really trippy and fun. And so that was definitely a different type of story and writing for me. But I think in the haze of young babies and sleep deprivation, some of my truest kind of feelings and connection to Appalachia came out through that writing.
You've gone on to do more and more hikes, but I wanted to ask you about one other hike in particular, and that's the Mountains to Sea hike. But I understand not only did you hike the entire thing, but with an infant. I'd love to hear some of your stories and what that experience was like.
Behind the Appalachian Trail, the Mountains to Sea Trail is probably my favorite. And for folks who are not familiar, it's a 1,200-mile footpath that stretches across the state of North Carolina from the Tennessee border to the Outer Banks. So when I approached that trail, the season of life I was in at that point, I had a four-year-old, and I had, when we started the trail, my son was 9.5 months old. I knew that I wasn't going to walk with my children the entire way, and had actually agreed to do the trail in support of the past 40th birthday, in support of the nonprofit Friends organization that runs the trail. We really wanted this to be a wonderful engagement and PR effort for North Carolina, for trails, for the Appalachian Mountains, for all these good things that we love. So along the way, I was hiking and I was guiding hikes for groups. I was giving talks along the way, and I was hosting fundraisers, all in support of this wonderful trail and organization. And by the way, I was nursing an infant and being mom to a four-year-old as well. And so the way logistically that worked, my husband would meet me at road crossings, and I was hiking morning to night. We would try to camp together or stay with friends off trail. He was caring for the kids along the way during the day. But, you know, I was nursing my son before I started hiking in the morning, and then the hike out, just totally, totally exhausted. I look back on that experience, and in a lot of ways, it was harder than the AT record. I mean, the AT record that we set gets a lot of attention and feels like this sexy, ooh, fastest person on the trail. But in a lot of ways, I was more humbled and more challenged by trying to do the Mountains to Sea Trail with two young children, caring for them, trying to navigate the relationship with my husband, who the effort was like extremely difficult for him as well, and all doing it for a really good reason and a really good cause. So there were a lot of emotions and a lot of effort that went into that endeavor, which took 3 months for us to go from Tennessee to the Outer Banks.
Wow, that's amazing. And I think also a lot of young parents hearing this will hear a metaphor for their lives as young parents or parents of young children. Jennifer Farr Davis, thank you so much for coming on Inside Appalachia and speaking with us.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me, and thanks to all you do to tell stories from this region. It's so great.
That was Jennifer Farr Davis of Western North Carolina. Davis sold Blue Ridge Hiking Company to pursue other interests, including her writing. Her new book is Five Star Trails, Asheville, 35 Spectacular Hikes in the Land of the Sky. This year, April 9th, marked the end of the holy month of Ramadan in the Islamic faith. During Ramadan, observant Muslims fast from sunup to sundown. Their fast is traditionally broken with a feast, called an iftar. In Morgantown, West Virginia, the meal was overshadowed this year by the war in Gaza. WVPB's Chris Schultz reports.
Just after sunset on a recent Sunday evening, the small lot in front of the Islamic Center of Morgantown is double parked with cars. Inside, men sit on the floor eating and drinking. The sound that dominates the room are the yells of children. Omar Yacoub says that's because the men have not eaten or had water since before sunrise, more than 12 hours ago, and are focused on getting something into their system before the evening prayer.
So today is just a typical day. People get together here before the evening prayer, which is the prayer whenever we hear the call for it, we break our fast. We just eat a date and probably a cup of water and then pray and then go back to eat something that's a little bit heavier.
Yacoub is a volunteer at the Islamic Center. Muslims pray five times a day, and having memorized the Quran, he sometimes leads the prayer on nights like tonight when the mosque's imam is not present. Yacoub says fasting and the month of Ramadan serve many purposes.
It can be self-discipline and self-control, teaching yourself that there are a lot of other things that you might think you cannot do, but you can actually do, like fasting.
Prayer and fasting are two of the five pillars of Islam, which include the Hajj, a pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca, and declaring one's faith. Yacoub says fasting can help motivate the fifth pillar, giving to charity.
It also helps you get the feeling of those families in need, those families who can stay for hours and hours without the ability to drink or eat anything. So that gives you a little bit of a motivation, a little bit of a push forward to give in charity, to donate money to these families in need.
Ultimately, the focus of Ramadan is personal, but breaking fast is often a communal experience. And after the evening prayer, the congregants return to the common room to eat a proper meal. At the Islamic Center, each night is sponsored by a different family or families. The people that make up the mosque's community are incredibly diverse, representing dozens of countries, from Libya to Bangladesh, and of course, the United States, which means each iftar can vary, but is always delicious.
We all share the same thing, you know, we fast the same, we ate the same food. Again, alhamdulillah, it's five different families making them. Everybody did the chicken in a different way.
Mohammed Hafeida is one of the sponsors of tonight's iftar. He says he got up at 1 a.m. to start cooking, but the effort is worthwhile because breaking fast and praying together as a community reminds him of the reason for Ramadan and fasting, to reset his perspective on what matters.
To me, it means I belong to a larger, very diverse group of people, and we share very, very common root human aspects, like hunger and thirst. And that's kind of going back to the basics. You know, when I say I'm hungry, I'm really hungry. When I say I'm thirsty, it becomes real thirst. It just makes you appreciate everything that you have so much more because you kind of reset your reference points.
Hafeida says this year the community is making a conscious decision to keep their iftars simple. With the war in Gaza stretching through the month of Ramadan and creating famine conditions for Muslims in the region, he says anything else felt inappropriate.
And I think it's just the minimum we can do is kind of remember our brothers and sisters so that we could act differently, because I don't think it's right when people are dying from hunger for us to, you know, bring the fancy dinners on. That's the bittersweet. We're still able to enjoy our meal, but we're trying to keep it simple so that we could relate to them as much as we can.
Omar Ibrahim is the president of the Muslim Student Association at West Virginia University. Ibrahim says their organization petitioned the mosque to hold community events like tonight's iftar because of their importance to students that are away from home for the holy month.
It's such an important thing that mainly college students depend on when you don't have your family here to eat iftar with. And you also need that sense of community that we really prioritize in Ramadan.
Nada Miki is the secretary of WVU's Muslim Student Association. She says she was raised to view Ramadan as a time for community and charity.
Ramadan is like kind of more focused on community and unity. It's like the broader image. And also back home, for example, it's the time where people go to take care of them and check on the poor if they need anything, send them food, send them money.
Miki views fasting from sunrise to sunset as a meditation in patience and the transient nature of life. A reminder that all things in life, good or bad, come to pass in their time. She tries to apply this to difficult situations, like the ongoing conflict in Gaza.
I don't think anybody would like to be hungry. It's not like a pleasant feeling. It's like all of these negative things that we might go through, there's gonna be a sunset for them. There's gonna be an end to this negative thing in our life. And this is basically teaching us patience and teaching us that no matter what we go through, there's gonna be an end of it.
After the iftar meal is complete, everyone pitches in to clean up quickly ahead of the day's final and longest prayer. Yaqub says this is an extra prayer, exclusive to Ramadan, beyond the five prayed every day of the year. He says it helps to make the month special and helps focus intentions for the next day of fasting, which, by the time the prayer ends around 11 p.m., is just a few short hours away. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
Fasting during the month of Ramadan presents special challenges for Muslim athletes. This year, the holy month began just as winter sports like college basketball went into the championship season, and spring sports like baseball and track began to pick up. The Eastern Kentucky University men's and women's track teams have some members from countries where athletic competition is suspended during Ramadan. But in the U.S., student athletes who are Muslim are still expected to compete. That creates challenges on and off the track. Stu Johnson with WEKU has this.
It might be characterized as challenging in a good way, the intersection of religious faith and conviction and the drive to succeed athletically. Ramadan, the ninth month of the Muslim calendar, is one of the most sacred times for those of the Islamic faith. Hakim Abrzuhir is a highly successful steeplechase runner from Morocco, and he's on the Colonel track team. The 26-year-old says a professor in 2009 took him to a running event near his village and said, "You would be a good runner." and thus started his interest in racing. Now, here in the United States these years later, Abu Zuhair competed while fasting during Ramadan.
Especially here in the United States, like different than Morocco, you know, because in Morocco everyone is fasting. That means you are like doing just something usual that everyone is doing. But here it's like a little challenging when you are like seeing people around you that are like eating. Then you feel like how you are a good believer or not.
Abu Zuhair says his event is a 3,000-meter race jumping barriers, including seven with water. He says the track competition includes a strong mental aspect, and the fasting period from sunrise to sunset makes one tougher. EKU track team coach Corey Erdman says all his runners are very dedicated, and that certainly pertains to Muslim members during the month-long religious observance. He admits it required some flexibility all the way around.
So they have to adjust a lot. As a staff, we have to adjust. Patrick and Mia, our assistant coaches, Dale, who all work with athletes who are observing Ramadan. We adjust schedules, they adjust their schedules. It adjusts essentially everything for everyone. But when you have individuals who are focused and who want to be better as athletes, you want to try to help them get better, and you're willing to sort of go the extra mile, and that's been our approach.
Erdman says modifications included training late at night or even 1 to 2 a.m. for the Muslim student athletes. But as far as performance, Hakeem Abu Zuhair won his race at Stanford. He said it was a bit easier running in the evening than a midday meet in Richmond, when breaking the fast didn't come till much later. Bahia El Arfai is a freshman also from Marrakesh. She competes in the 800, the 1500, and cross country. When it came time to break a fast at the end of the day, she missed her mother's cooking and preparation, but she gave it a try.
Not good at all. I'm still practicing. I just go and check YouTube every time. So I ruin the house every time, but it's okay. It's really good. It's benefited me to like handle that and rely on myself sometimes.
Adjustments for the Ramadan observance when it comes to competition are not an issue in her home country. El Arfai says there's no racing during Ramadan there. She says it means a lot when track coaches acknowledge the religious period.
Our coach Mia, she really tried to fast with us at the beginning, so she motivated me to go and just race, because I know that's so tough for you and that's hard, and I feel that because she tried and fast, I think, for more than 10 days.
El Arfai said that made her happy to see other people know her situation and feel the same thing, and having a community of people of her faith is very important. Mohamed Jouari echoes that sentiment. Also from Morocco, Jouari is another distance runner. He says fellowship during this time of observing one of the five pillars of Islam makes a big difference. Jouari says competitors might think a time of fasting, especially on race day, would be a major factor, but he says that's not how he feels when running a race.
I feel like God is helping me twice as like a normal day without Ramadan. Like, you're doing something for God, and He will never like fail you. So He's always be by your side.
Hakeem Abu Zuhair has a similar feeling about experiencing Ramadan and continuing with athletic training and events. And nourishment comes in different forms.
The food is not just what makes you strong. It's the spirit, like, level of your life. When you are like a good believer and you believe in Allah, you believe in God, it's whatever. It gives you like a huge energy to perform in a good level.
Prayers offered at the Richmond Mosque last week as part of the Eid celebration. The community gathering marks the end of the Ramadan observance. The period of Ramadan is based on moon sightings. Ramadan 2025 is projected to begin on February 28th and end March 30th. Hakeem, Mo, and Bahia will likely be observing and competing once again. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
A lot of us hear the word recycling and think of something that's good for the environment. But chemical recycling has some people worried about pollution and safety. A new series takes a look at the issues. The Allegheny Front's Carol Holsapple reports.
Plants for chemical recycling, or what the industry calls advanced recycling of plastics, have been proposed in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. Christina Marusik, a reporter with Environmental Health News, has a new series about these facilities. I asked her what chemical recycling is.
Chemical recycling is an umbrella term for a bunch of different processes that use heat or chemicals or both to break down plastic waste into parts that can be used either as fuel or to create more plastic. And that's different from traditional recycling, which is also sometimes called mechanical recycling, which breaks down plastic waste physically, but not at a molecular level.
What are the environmental and health concerns around chemical recycling?
Chemical recycling is really energy intensive. It's a lot more energy intensive than mechanical recycling. And the process releases some greenhouse gases, which contribute to climate change. And these facilities also emit toxic chemicals and create toxic waste, things like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, dioxins, a whole bunch of other persistent pollutants, volatile organic compounds, and heavy metals. And those pollutants are associated with health effects like elevated cancer risk, respiratory disease, and damage to kidneys, livers, and nervous systems. The chemicals that are involved in chemical recycling are also really flammable. So these facilities are prone to accidents and fires. Fires and explosions have been reported at chemical recycling plants in Texas and Denmark and Finland. And there's a big facility in Ashley, Indiana, that's had a number of really big fires that were big enough that some workers said they felt their lives were threatened at the time.
Why is the chemical recycling industry looking to this region specifically?
A lot of people don't know that 95% of plastic is made from fossil fuels, maybe even more, upwards of 95%. And this region already has a lot of infrastructure related to the oil and gas industry. So we have fracking wells, we have pipelines, we have kind of established transportation routes, we have compressor stations, we also have the Shell ethane cracker making plastic nurdles to be made into bigger plastics here in Western Pennsylvania. And this existing infrastructure makes it more convenient to put kind of related facilities nearby. Pennsylvania is also one of 24 states that have passed laws reclassifying chemical recycling as manufacturing plants rather than as waste disposal plants, which makes permitting easier and reduces regulatory oversight for these kinds of facilities. Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky have also passed these bills, which are being pushed by the industry and the American Chemistry Council, and it makes the whole Appalachian region and the Ohio River Valley more attractive for these types of facilities.
That was Christina Marusik from Environmental Health News, speaking with the Allegheny Front's Carol Holzapfel. It's a great time to be a birder in Appalachia. Pay attention, you might notice bald eagles, peregrine falcons, whippoorwills, and a truly stunning number of songbirds. Appalachia is also home to a variety of owls, which tend to be heard more than seen. But however you encounter them, owls are fascinating. They're nocturnal and hunt in the dark. They fly slower than most other birds, but they're also quiet, which makes them great predators. But sometimes, even owls need a little help, especially if they happen to find themselves alone in the world. WFA's Nick DeLaCanal brings us this story about great horned owls at the Carolina Raptor Center.
Inside this small cabin, the floor is covered with pebbles and wooden perches jut out from the wall.
So we always wear gloves, even with babies.
Sunny Cooper, in a Raptor Center hoodie, puts on a pair of thick gloves. She reaches into a small blue cardboard box on the ground and pulls out a little fluffy owlet.
So we're just going to kind of pick them up just like you would basketball or volleyball.
The baby owl clicks its beak and looks around with bewildered yellow eyes. Cooper cradles it and then lowers the bird into a kennel with soft towels and food.
It's an unhappy owlet.
This little owlet is an orphan. It's just a few weeks old and was separated from its parents when construction workers in Matthews cut down their tree. they likely didn't know owls were nesting there.
Great horns like to nest way, way, way up in pine trees, between like 40 and 60 feet up in the air.
That's about four stories high. Usually, staff want to reunite chicks with their parents. But if a chick is abandoned or a nest is destroyed, the chicks are brought here, to the Owl Orphan Center. Although in reality, it's more like a foster home.
We want babies to be able to see an adult. It helps them kind of learn who they are, appropriate behaviors.
The chicks live in one room, and an adult owl lives in another. And they can see and talk to each other through a window with wooden slats.
She might fly back this way. There she is.
Cooper peeks in on the foster mom. She's a majestic bird with light and dark brown speckles and those tufted feathers that look like horns.
You can see that she's a little bit uncoordinated right now, and that's because her wing was wrapped for a long time.
This owl was rescued after getting tangled up in barbed wire. Staff are nursing her to health while letting the chicks watch her and learn how to be a grown-up.
When we walk in and the baby can see that the adult is afraid of us, that adult doesn't want anything to do with us, that's a behavior that they can also learn. Like, oh, there's something that looks like me that's afraid of this kind of common thing. I too should be afraid of this.
As the hospital manager at the Raptor Center, it's Cooper's job to look after these birds and coordinate foster families with her team.
It's a lot of hard work to get a single patient through the process. It's a lot of food. It's a lot of food prep. It's a lot of reviewing charts, treatment plans, and things like that.
She's been doing this for 5 years, and not out of pure selflessness or just for a paycheck. She says she helps these avian patients in part for the joy she gets when, after months of intense care, she watches a recovered or grown-up bird released back into the wild.
Here's a bird that you've seen from potentially death's door when they show up or in really bad shape, who you have and your team have worked really hard to kind of nurse back to health and release.
These owlets still have several more weeks before they return to the trees around Charlotte. Same for the adult owl. And if they hadn't been rescued, it's likely none would have survived. This kind of work shows that while humans are often responsible for the destruction of habitat and wildlife, we're also capable of helping and looking after other species. And that might say more about us than a little baby owl. In Charlotte, I'm Nick Della Canale.
Until next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by Hot Dog, Sean Watkins, John Blissard, Jeff Ellis, Brew Davis, and Dinosaur Burps. Bill Lynch is our producer. Xander Alloy is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Eric Douglas. Kelly Libby is our editor. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. We had help this week from Folkways editor Nicole Musgrave. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter, @InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to subscribe or stream all of our stories. Or look for Inside Appalachia on your favorite podcast app. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.